This is a case of the new Pakistani government following up on one of its promises to be more fiscally responsible.
Budget concerns again hit China's Belt and Road Initiative. It's Tuesday, October 2nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Follow us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a U.S.-China military meeting is canceled. China's economy slows some more. Indonesia rescue teams battle debris and time. Killing malaria mosquitoes, tracking climate change in the far north. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Pakistan's rail minister says the country's largest Chinese-funded Silk Road rail project will have its budget cut by $2 billion, citing debt concerns. The project to restore the aging rail lines from Karachi to Peshawar was initially priced at $8.2 billion, but concerns over the cost has led to delays. The new government of populist Prime Minister Imran Khan has been cautious about taking on the rail projects. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, the reason for that.
Well, one of the vows that the new government led by Imran Khan has come out with is that it's going to be much more responsible and prudent about how it deals with all of these very large investments coming in from China as part of this broader China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, this huge infrastructure project tailing all kinds of roads and railroads across China. And Imran Khan has vowed that Pakistan is not going to follow the same policy that the previous government did, which was basically to let China throw in all the loans it wanted to and not worry about the economic consequences of how to pay back all that money. So this government has vowed to be much more responsible and that it will weigh each contract, each deal before it actually agrees to sign off on it. So I think that this is a case of the new Pakistani government following up on one of its promises to be more fiscally responsible. And I think it's a pretty good idea.
What is the opinion of the population of Pakistan about this, or doesn't it even register?
Well, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, China is a very popular player in Pakistan. China and Pakistan have a very deep relationship. While many in Pakistan tend to be very critical of the United States and other countries in the West, as well as India, of course, you know, views of China and what it is doing in Pakistan tend to be fairly positive. But I do think that the government is taking a big risk here because a lot of key players, including the very powerful army in Pakistan, are fully supportive of these very extensive Chinese loans coming into Pakistan, and they want this project to move forward in a big way.
Even with a cut of $2 billion, does that leave any room for the project to go ahead?
Well, yes, and it certainly is possible for the two sides to come together and try to renegotiate the loans and the financing to allow it to move forward. I mean, Pakistan is not, you know, cutting off, you know, $2 billion just because it doesn't like the project. It's just very unhappy with the financing terms. So if you could renegotiate the terms, if you can get China to renegotiate the terms, then I think Pakistan would be happy to move forward. But it's true that $2 billion is a lot of money for you and me, but it's not enough to torpedo the entire enterprise.
Has China made any other moves with countries that either cannot or will not support its loan offers? We know that Thailand, Laos, Sri Lanka, Maldives all have voiced complaints about the terms of the loans from China. And Malaysia's new prime minister canceled a $20 billion rail project in August. Is this just part of a larger scheme here?
Well, absolutely. I think China clearly recognizes that there's a problem, but it needs to be fixed. I think Beijing recognizes that this pattern of pouring huge amounts of money into very poor countries and expecting these countries to be able to absorb the loans and pay back the debts, it's untenable. And you know, China hasn't really acted, hasn't actually taken any corrective actions to deal with the challenge yet. But I think it increasingly recognizes that it's going to need to renegotiate some of these deals with these countries if it wants this huge Belt and Road Initiative, the name for this global project to develop more infrastructure around the world. If it wants that to move forward, it's going to need to be more flexible and renegotiate the deals. And given how important this huge infrastructure game is for China, I think it will be increasingly flexible and realizes that it's worth its while, and it certainly will serve its interest if it sits down with these countries, including Pakistan, and tries to figure out how to move forward.
Has the U.S. chimed in on this whole situation worldwide with the Belt and Road so far?
I mean, the United States has been very coy. It hasn't really taken a formal position at all. I mean, it hasn't opposed this project, but it hasn't supported it. The big question is the extent to which China is going to try to militarize these investments. And that's why there's been a lot of talk and rumors that China could try to build some type of military facilities along with these investment projects. So in Pakistan, there's been speculation that China would try to build some type of naval facility off the port of Gwadar, which is a warm water port in southern Pakistan, which China is financing and building as part of the CPEC arrangement. Now, it's unclear to what extent that could happen. That would certainly set off alarm bells in India. It would be seen as very provocative. But at the end of the day, I think that we can't rule out the possibility that China would try to project its power globally by, you know, developing these military-type investments and not just restricting themselves to the roads and the railroads and these strictly economic initiatives.
Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Indonesia to accept foreign aid for tsunami rescue efforts. Pentagon cancels talks with China amid rising tensions. Korea's begin removing landmines along their border. Three churches closed in Indonesia. Christian group pledges legal aid. Questions remain over Comfort Women Foundation future as protests continue. You know where to find more on these stories. It's at voanews.com and also on Facebook at VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A U.S. defense official has told VOA that the Pentagon has canceled plans for Defense Secretary Jim Mattis to visit China after his counterpart in Beijing could not be made available. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details in this conversation with International Edition host Sarah Williams.
This was decided late last week, and these things happen from time to time, and they usually go unreported, but what is so significant about this particular cancellation is that it's coming on a pattern of cancellations, because China last week recalled its naval chief. That naval chief was supposed to be meeting with Admiral Richardson, who is the chief of naval operations for the United States. And then China also denied a Hong Kong port visit request from the USS Wasp warship. They had wanted to come in October, and China said no.
Is this all because of the continuing tensions over the South China Sea?
We think that it is a combination of several tensions. Beijing is not happy over the current trade war. Washington last week placed tariffs on, I believe it was another $200 billion on Chinese imports. And there are also high tensions over an arms sale to Taiwan. Beijing considers Taiwan a renegade province, and Trump just authorized $1.3 billion worth of arms sales there. But yes, I think the South China Sea has a large part to do with this tension as well. Just over the weekend, on Sunday, the USS Decatur sailed within 12 nautical miles, that's about 22, 23 kilometers, of the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. They call this a freedom of navigation operation. The U.S. does these because they say that anybody should be able to sail and fly in international waters and international airspace, but the Chinese feel like it is their airspace. And then furthermore, I've just learned from a U.S. defense official that this particular operation was deemed unsafe. One person told me that the Chinese military ship came dangerously close to the USS Decatur, so we're still waiting on word on exactly what happened on Sunday. That follows two other freedom of navigation operations in the airspace, we should say. The B-52 bombers of the U.S. Air Force conducted operations over the South China Sea and the East China Sea last week, which is obviously called provocative by the Chinese.
VOA's Carla Babb reporting from the Pentagon. The trip was never finalized or formally announced, and as Carla mentioned, the announcement comes as the U.S. military has conducted several freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. Happening now in Asia, a protest in Hong Kong on China's National Day was organized by the Civil Human Rights Front to voice concerns about the loss of freedom and democracy. Police denied access to a public square as more than 1,000 pro-democracy protesters marched in the streets. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Two surveys show shrinking Chinese exports in September. The official manufacturing purchasing index stood at 50.8 last month. That was down from 51.3 in August. While the Taishin Manufacturing PMI, a gauge of smaller private company sentiment, dipped to 50 from 50.6. A reading of 50 is the dividing point between expansion and contraction. Many observers say this is the result of trade tensions between China and the United States. Washington has imposed tariffs on $250 billion in Chinese imports. Beijing has retaliated with penalties on $110 billion U.S. imports. And the two sides are not negotiating differences over trade and economic policies. But longtime China analyst Patrick Chovanec is a chief strategist at the New York-based Silvercrest Asset Management. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty it's not surprising the Chinese economy is slowing, but it is not necessarily the result of trade tensions with Washington, at least not yet.
The Chinese government pumped a lot of credit and a lot of investment into the Chinese economy last year because of the Party Congress that was taking place. And that was going to recede, and so the economy was going to slow. So whether or not there was going to be a trade war, the Chinese economy was already on track to see a slowdown.
Will the trade tensions exacerbate that, do you think?
It's quite possible that the trade frictions between the U.S. and China will have a negative impact on the Chinese economy and the U.S. economy as well. And I think that if you look at what's happened to the Chinese stock market, obviously a lot of investors are bracing for that. But I want to emphasize that the Chinese economy was already going to slow down simply because it couldn't keep up the pace that it had achieved last year.
It's also transitioning. Is it less of an export-driven market?
The Chinese economy has become less dependent on exports, but it's become more dependent on investment. A lot of that investment won't earn a return unless the demand is going to come from somewhere, and China hasn't undertaken the internal rebalancing in order to absorb that investment. And so, you know, there's been external rebalancing of the Chinese economy, but not internal rebalancing that would allow it a more sustainable path forward.
Do you expect the Chinese government will step in and make some economic policy changes to improve performance?
Unfortunately, they have been aggressively stepping in over the past several years to try to prop up growth, but it actually makes a lot of the imbalances in the Chinese economy worse. So they pump up investment, they pump up the availability of credit, and that actually just digs the hole deeper. And so really, a slowdown in China's economy is something that is long overdue, and they should try to manage and should try to actually embrace. But the fact that it's taking place at a time of growing trade tensions between the U.S. and China means that China may dig in further and try to prop up the economy that it's got.
Would that encourage the Chinese to engage in negotiations with the U.S., which are apparently not taking place right now?
Ironically, I think that actually the pressure that's being brought to bear on the Chinese is not pushing them in the right direction towards more open markets. It's pushing them to dig in. And it's not that there aren't concessions that could potentially be made. And it's always possible that there's a deal, depending on how high a bar the U.S. sets. But for right now, it looks like China is digging in and trying to prop up its economy in any way that it can, rather than make concessions that it sees. It's interpreting U.S. pressure right now as an attempt to contain and keep China down, rather than some kind of win-win. So as long as that's their view. I think that they're just kind of going to hunker down and try to withstand the damage from a trade war, even though in the long run, that's not good for the Chinese economy.
Patrick Chovanec said with command or state-run economy like China's, a lot can be done to insulate itself from market forces. He said while the effect may be effective in the short term, in the longer term, it's not healthy. Coming up, the tsunami aftermath. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, Typhoon Trami is making landfall in Kagoshima, Japan, after it battered Japan's southern island of Okinawa, leaving dozens of people injured. There's more on this and the day's other stories online at VOA 60. Also visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, rescue teams are searching for survivors on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, which was hit by a 7.5 magnitude earthquake and a tsunami on Friday. Officials said Sunday more than 800 people were killed in the disaster, and they expect that number to rise. VOA's Slotika Hoke reports Red Cross officials say at least 1.5 million people have been affected.
Rescuers have been digging mostly by hand in search of survivors buried under the debris in the city of Palu. The National Search and Rescue Agency says they desperately need heavy machinery to remove the rubble.
It would be dangerous if search teams go in there because we are still having aftershocks. I really hope the local government will be able to get us heavy machinery.
The powerful earthquake triggered tsunami waves as high as 6 meters, which devastated homes and swept people away. Survivors describe a harrowing experience.
I was carried by the wave about 50 meters. I couldn't hold on to anything. The water was spinning me around. There was a shop with bars over the front. I climbed it. That was where I rested. Then a second wave came, even higher than the first. Suddenly, I was on the roof.
Someone told me my brother was okay, so I felt relieved. But we waited and waited until into the night, until the morning, but he never returned.
Meanwhile, the death toll is growing. Officials say the final death toll could be in the thousands.
There are still unidentified bodies, as well as victims buried under ruins. There are also remote areas yet to be reached by joint search and rescue teams.
Indonesian President Joko Widodo visited the tsunami-devastated Palu waterfront on Sunday.
Everything is still at an emergency status, but the most important thing I would like to emphasize to all ministries, military, police, and regional administration is first to focus on all things related to the recovering victims from the wreckage.
Coastal cities of Palu and Donggala in central Sulawesi province were hit the hardest by the massive tsunami. The region has experienced more than 200 aftershocks and serious damage to the airport, roads, communications, and other important infrastructure. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
This news from VOA Asia, South Korea's President Moon Jae-in has announced recent military agreements establishing specific measures for real peace between the two Koreas that would, quote, end all hostile acts on the land, sea, and sky. See more online at VOA 60 and always get the big stories through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, scientists have managed to wipe out a population of mosquitoes in a laboratory using a type of genetic engineering known as a gene drive. The intervention prevented the females from reproducing and caused the entire population to die off. Henry Ridgewell reports scientists hope the method can be transferred from the lab to the real world to tackle mosquito populations that spread diseases like malaria.
Mosquitoes spread malaria that kills an estimated 429,000 people every year, many of them children. So this new method of killing mosquito populations has sparked huge interest. scientists from Imperial College London managed to eliminate a population of breeding mosquitoes in a laboratory using a gene drive. Professor Andrea Crisanti co-led the research.
The gene drive is a technical solution that allows a genetic modification to be spread from few individuals to an entire population.
That modification involved disrupting a gene that determines sexual differentiation.
So in this way, a genetic female, if you destroy this gene, cannot develop into a female, but develop in something between a male and a female that we call intersex. These individuals cannot bite, so which is very good, cannot lay egg, and so cannot reproduce itself.
That inability to reproduce spread across the mosquitoes, and the entire population died off within 11 generations. The big question is whether that success can be replicated outside the laboratory.
We've already done, we've moved this mosquito in large confined space which mimic completely the tropical environment. Then after this is completed, this phase will also be crucial to gather a lot of information for regulatory purpose, for example about safety, stability, ability of the gene drive to move across the species.
Scientists say reassuring the public about the safety of this powerful technique is paramount. It's hoped the gene drive can be tested in the wild within 5 to 10 years. New tools in the fight against malaria are urgently needed, as the World Health Organization says global progress against the disease is stalling. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
An observatory in Barrow, Alaska, the most northerly astronomical outpost in the United States, has become a key scientific instrument in studying climate change. Established in 1973, the Barrow Observatory is staffed year-round by two researchers who plot, measure, and track changes in air quality and weather, while also acclimating themselves with the local traditions. Natasha Magoyeva traveled to Barrow, Alaska, now officially called Utqiagvik in its original Inupiaq name, to see what life is like in one of the coldest and snowiest places in the world.
Ryan Thomas is station chief at the northernmost scientific outpost in the United States, the Barrow Observatory. Since 2015, he and a colleague have trudged through ice and snow, taking measurements of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to track minute changes in Earth's climate. The town's isolation with wind that has bypassed large cities allows them to collect quality air samples.
Here we're monitoring for ozone-depleting gases. These are compounds that were prohibited by the Montreal Protocol, which was signed in the early 90s. All the parties to the Montreal Protocol have agreed not to use these substances anymore.
Recently, Brian also started monitoring the amount of methane in soil. It has been released from the ground as rising temperatures melt Alaska's permafrost.
Methane is a greenhouse gas, so there's concern that that might contribute to the warming of the Earth.
Thomas's work is unaffected by climate change policies in the White House, although the results might be interpreted differently than in the past.
My job here is to take the measurements like we've been doing for 40 years. The measurements show that the carbon dioxide, for example, is increasing in the atmosphere. We know the physics of that. We know what that means for the atmosphere and what we do about it and who does what about it and when is a policy decision and a politics decision that I don't have a direct influence on.
Thomas came here in 2007 from his hometown of Sacramento, California. But this is home to his 4-year-old son, Ellis, who was born here and goes to immersive kindergarten where he learns the local native language, Inupiaq.
It excites me that he is interested in doing that, and my older daughters as well are interested in the culture.
The cold climate may not be conducive to meeting people, but Thomas says it hasn't stopped his family from making friends. It's the friendly polar bears he worries about.
There was a white mound underneath the platform of the satellite antenna, and the bear was coming from the lagoon. It was coming from the ocean, and it had probably been on land for a few hours, and it wanted a place to rest.
Just another part of life for those who live and work in the northernmost community in the United States, at the very edge of the Arctic Ocean. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Utqiagvik, Barrow, Alaska.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Hear us on iTunes and SoundCloud. Hear us on our website, voanews.com. Hear us on VOA Asia Facebook. and hear us on many great radio stations around Asia, like Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Thanks to everyone there who is tuning in today. And of course, our thanks always go to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Keith Holmes, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team that includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.